What's up, everybody, and welcome to the Lawyer You Know podcast. I'm your host, attorney Peter Tragos, and on this podcast, we break down the trials and cases you care most about so that you can understand how the American criminal and civil justice system works. We try to make sure you understand your rights by answering your questions as, well, a lawyer that you know. So we want to walk you through this process, and we can do it together. Make sure you get in the comments or in the chats to ask the questions that have been burning in your minds. And while this is not legal advice, it's always exciting. So buckle up for another episode of The Lawyer You Know. What's up, everybody? And welcome back in for a little more Murdoch talk. You guys are continuing to send me more and more videos from YouTube, interviews, comments, discussions by people involved, and how they might affect the appellate process, what we think it means about the trial. So we're going to review three of those. Yes, three of those in today's video. The three that were most sent to me over the last literal 24 hours since I did the prior video on the jurors. And those three articles and videos are, first, we're going to do a short video about 5 minutes on Cuomo. Jim Griffin gives his comments, answer some real questions for us that I think are going to be really interesting for our discussion. Second, I'm going to read some quotes from an article interviewing Randy Murdoch, Alex's brother, who still works at the firm as a partner at the firm. He had a lot to say about some of it, responding to Jim Griffin's comments, where he stands. Does he think Alex Murdoch did it? Does he not think he did it? Where does he stand? We get a lot of information there, and how he doesn't seem to be on the same page with some people in the family or anybody, really. Seems to be in his own kind of spot, which he was very close to the situation, especially with the financial crime. So we'll get to that, break that comment down. And then last, Juror James has a 30-plus minute interview on law and crime. So we're going to listen to that together. We're going to listen to that one sped up so we can get through it all. Some of it are repetitive comments. Some of it's new stuff. We will break that down as well. A ton of you sent me that. I'm surprised because we've already talked about his comments, but you guys want to talk about it. Like I said, if I get the DMs on Twitter and Instagram at Tragos Law, follow me on there. If there's stuff you want me to break down, a lot of people sending me other cases. What's next? I can't jump into another trial right now. I'm a little exhausted from the last one. So as far as videos go, and like you guys know, I do this for fun. I really enjoy it. So I'm not just going to burn out doing a million trials every single week, pick up another one. The ones that are really interesting that most of you guys want, I will handle that content, right? One-offs are going to be more difficult, but because so many of you sent me this interview with Juror James, we will break it down here together. That'll be the last video we watch. So we're going to start now with Jim Griffin, then we'll get to Randy Murdoch, and then Juror James. Hit that like button on this video if you want me to continue to follow up on this Murdoch stuff and break it down when I have time, and just kind of throw it in there. And when we start to add to what we can understand and get more context on this case, I do think it's important. A lot of this stuff happening outside of court, which I think now, after the jury has reached his verdict, is the appropriate time to break it down, which is why also tonight, hopefully you guys can join me for the 200K celebration. We've got some special guests. Also, some fun things in the work in the future with some of your favorite lawyers on YouTube. And tomorrow night, or actually, I don't know if it's going to be nighttime or probably during the day, I'm going to react to the Netflix series, which I'm almost done with. And then I'll do HBO and some other ones. Again, you guys are sending these in my DMs, and that's how, and on Twitter, and that's how I'm choosing the content here, is based on what you want. So let's get to Jim Griffin. Let's hear what he said. We have heard some comments. We have heard some reporting, but I like to hear it from the horse's mouth, not the horse's mouth, as they say. So let's listen to this together.
News Nation exclusive. Joining us in his first live interview since the verdict is one of Alex Murdoch's main attorneys, Jim Griffin. Counselor, thank you very much for taking the opportunity.
Hey, Chris, glad to be here.
First question. I know this fight is not over for you. You guys definitely are going to figure out the team, but you plan a vigorous appeal. We'll talk about that. But when you heard that they were back with a verdict, what did you think it was going to be?
Well, because it came back so quickly and doing this for 30 plus years, I mean, that's normally a sign of it's a guilty verdict. We were shocked that they did come back so quickly.
That's absolutely what everybody thought, right? Everybody who does this type of work, everybody who's tried these kinds of cases, it's what I tweeted immediately was, wow, this quick, it's guilty. I would be shocked if it's not guilty. They all felt the same way. They were surprised at the timing. I was a little surprised at the timing. I wasn't shocked at the timing, but I was surprised at the timing. And again, it's a real kick to the stomach when you do all this work for 6 weeks and the jury's just like, nope, he's guilty. We don't care what you say.
And but having learned that they had a verdict within 3 hours of going out, we were not surprised when it was read out into the courtroom. You know, we'd prepared Alec that that's likely what it would be. But, you know, to say we were disappointed is a tremendous understatement.
Tell us why. And,
well, I mean, as you said in your opening, there was so much, it was 6 weeks of evidence, and there was so little evidence on the actual murders. There's no murder weapons. There's no bloody clothes. There's no motive to the murder. And so we thought the jury would.
And listen, here's what's interesting. He says there's no motive. And a lot of you, I'm sure, immediately in the comments are going to be like, what about the financial crimes? There was absolutely a motive. A lot of the jurors have said that that was kind of a weak motive, or they didn't put a lot of stock in the financial crimes because they could only consider it for motive. Not a lot of the jurors hung on motive. They hung more on he snapped, all this stuff was going on, he couldn't handle it, didn't know what to do, and he snapped more as the motive than this was planned and plotted out because of the financial crimes to cover them up, which I think is really interesting that, you know, Griffin's going to say there's no motive. We heard weeks of motive, weeks of arguing about motive in this trial. So I wouldn't say there was no motive, but it's interesting hearing the jurors' comments after how it wasn't as powerful as many would have thought for the evidence of motive.
Would have to work through a lot of that. And then the state's timeline or time of death was based upon a reconstruction of a lot of convoluted cell phone data, which was challenged greatly by our experts. There was missing data. And so the time of death was in question. And because of all those issues, we thought the jury would have to work through, you know, a number of matters. And that would take quite some time. And when they came back within less than 3 hours, and I heard the reports that you just reported on, that one of the jurors says it was 45 minutes, which that's not deliberation. And so, you know, that is concerning, frankly.
And again, there's going to be a lot of comments about lawyers don't get it. Lawyers don't get jurors. They're thinking like lawyers, not like jurors. Some of that may be true, but lawyers are the ones that can affect the process, right? A lot of lawyers, and again, I don't necessarily mean trial lawyers, but a lot of people that went to law school that are politicians, that are judges, that are lawyers, write these rules, edit these rules, and none of them are super excited about a 40-minute deliberation. We want to protect the process. We want it to be a fair process. And there are cases where it's absolutely overwhelming. The evidence is going one way, and you know, you can't argue with it. When there is some nuance and it only takes 40 minutes, a lot of eyebrows are raised, regardless of people are going to stand in front of a camera and admit that to you. Okay. But I'm just telling you, I've been in conversations with people that write these rules. I've been in the process of writing the rules and editing the rules for our trials, especially civil trials here in Florida. And my dad is in the rulemaking process of the criminal trials here in Florida and actually around the world, around the country, I should say. The eyebrows will be raised here. I'm just telling it to you honestly. I'm not saying it's going to change this verdict. I'm not saying it makes Alec Murdoch not guilty or makes him innocent. Nowhere in my mind is that coming in. I'm talking about the process overall. We want to make sure we put the right instructions in place so the jury does go back and deliberate appropriately. And in some cases, 40 minutes may be enough. Is this one of those cases? We'll see as we go through the appellate process. I think, as I sit right now, I don't think this is going to get overturned. But based on the 40 minutes, there's no way it's going to get overturned because of that. The only way it gets overturned, in my opinion, is the 404B evidence.
I want to ask you a couple of tangential questions. Maybe you know the answer to. The prosecution made a point yesterday to point out after the trial, none of the Murdochs thanked the prosecution for getting justice for Maggie and Paul. Is that true? Do you know whether or not any of the members of the family, or is this just too complicated emotionally for them?
Chris, I've spent the last 6 weeks with the family. They, coming into this trial, they were pitched, if you will, by the state, the Attorney General's office and SLED on the evidence that they believed proved that Alec murdered Maggie and Paul. And, you know, frankly, significant pieces of that evidence were never presented at trial because it didn't exist. For example,
I haven't watched this whole interview. I assume he's going to talk about the blood spatter on the shirt.
For example, there was, you know, much ado about blood spatter, which is high velocity blood that someone would get as a blowback if you shoot someone or if you're near someone who's been shot. And that was a big part of the state's case when they went to the grand jury. And that was a big part of the state's case as they told the family why they believe Alec committed these crimes. And then moving forward, going to trial, as we learned during discovery and we brought up during trial that there's no blood on the shirt. So how could there be blood spatter? And that was one example of promises made but not kept through evidence. And I can tell you, as the trial wore on after 6 weeks, where the family was waiting for some proof positive that Alec, who they couldn't believe would kill Maggie and Paul, they wanted to see evidence of him doing that. And they didn't see evidence. And
so this is a situation where you have a presumption of innocence, right? But when you talk about family members of the defendant, in this case, the defendant and the victims, same family. So they're also family members of the victim. But these family members may have started out even further on the innocent side. Like they could not believe it. You have to just like knock them over with proof. And Griffin's going to say the state was promising to give proof like that, and they just never did. And a lot of you think there was knock me over with proof. I don't personally think there was knock me over with proof, but I think there was enough proof or evidence that if the jury wanted to decide the way they decided, that it's appropriate. Based on what was allowed in, I think this is absolutely not a runaway jury. This is not a jury that did what no reasonable jury could do. No way. I think it was totally appropriate and justified for the jury to come back with a guilty verdict. Doesn't mean that's what I would have done, right? But I think the family, according to Jim Griffin, was promised, I'm going to get hit over the head with evidence that proves it, and we're going to have no choice but to believe Alec Murdoch did this at the end, and they weren't given that. So therefore, I heard another comment by him saying, they're more convinced that he's innocent now after the trial. Now, Randy Murdoch, brother of Alec Murdoch, we're going to get to some of his comments after this, and I think it's interesting to just talk about these back to back.
Coming away from the trial, they were more convinced than ever that he did not do it.
Okay.
And that's where they stand this evening.
In terms of why the jury reached the verdict it did, do you believe that this was a function of miscalculation or misperception or just a straight up miscarriage of justice?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. I believe the end result is a miscarriage of justice. And there's a number of reasons I believe we got to that point. The biggest one is that we were unsuccessful in convincing Judge Newman, who we have the greatest respect for, that the evidence of financial crimes should not be presented to the jury, that that should be a separate matter, and it would just be character evidence. It would paint Alec as a bad person. And the state, as you know, argued, no, it's part of the motive of why he would kill Maggie and Paul. And we thought the link from him being confronted as to whether he diverted some attorney's fees and maybe having a motion hearing coming up was just insufficient and frankly illogical that someone would then go home and kill their wife and son.
All right. So it seems like there was more to that interview, but that's the one that was most often sent to me. So that's what we played here today to give you a clip of how Jim Griffin's feeling and what he kind of thinks about this process. Okay. So we heard that. Now let's get to some comments by Randy Murdoch. And again, these are quotes from an article. I like to see the video better. I have not seen a video of this. You all were sending me this article, New York Times and other places. So let's just get to some of the quotes and we'll react to them as I read. So asked directly whether he thought his brother carried out the murders, he said he still did not know. So what does that mean? That means he was not convinced Alec Murdoch is innocent, but he absolutely would have voted not guilty. He is a lawyer. So he, throughout this article, did not feel like there was enough proof to where he now knows what happens, like this jury does. This jury is doing interviews. They feel confident that they know what happened. The state proved it to them. He doesn't agree there. As a lawyer, he said he respects the jury's verdict, but he finds it impossible to picture Alex, a man he has known for decades as a protective husband and father, pulling the trigger and inflicting the carnage that prosecutors described as a crime of cold calculation. So it does seem like he is buying the defense's argument, right? Don't you think that? I mean, that's what the defense was arguing, that this loving and protective father and husband could never do such a heinous, cold-blooded thing to his family. And then Randy says, so here he is not all the way on the defense side, very clearly. Here's a quote. He knows more than he is saying. He is not telling the truth, in my opinion, about everything there. The not knowing is the worst thing there is. Those are quotes, you know, probably direct quotes from Randy Murdoch. So he still thinks Alec's lying. He still thinks he knows more than he's saying. And maybe he thinks he had something to do with it. I'm adding that in there, right? That's not a quote. But now reading again, Randy Murdoch, who emphasized that he was speaking for himself and not his relatives. He was not called to testify, and he thinks it's possible because no one put him on the stand because he did not align perfectly with either side. To me, I feel like a lot of the witnesses did not align perfectly with either side. They answered honestly with both sides, and the jury just took it as he probably did it. or I should say he did it beyond a reasonable doubt. Alex, when they were talking about lying about the financial stuff, he said Alex promised that he wouldn't lie to him anymore. Within 24 hours, he broke that promise with the side of the road incident. He said, and this would be really damning. This is why the defense didn't call him. I spent considerable time, day after day, weeks on end, calling people, but Alex never did. Sorry, I messed that up. So the quote is, I spent weeks and weeks, day after day, weeks on end, calling people. That's the end of the quote. And then, but Alex, he said, never did. So interesting. They didn't quote that part. Maggie's sister testified to the same effect. And you know how other people in the family were trying to do everything they could to find the killers, but Alex did not. It seemed like Randy would have confirmed that, which I think would have gone right in line with the state's theory and with what the jury was buying and the road they were going down, is he didn't do all this stuff like a normal person would or like a loving husband would, because he did it. He said he never really expected, this is back from the article, he said he never really expected the murder trial to offer him the definitive answer he has been looking for. So he knew already, in my opinion, that SLED screwed up this investigation. They didn't have enough evidence to actually prove it to whatever his notion is and whatever he needed to make this proof, right? Which in the jury's verdict doesn't matter, because the jury had to be proved. They had to prove it to the jury, and the state did that, right? So I want to keep that in mind. Context is really important. But as far as he goes, this was not enough to prove it to Randy Murdoch. He said it. He hoped that it was going to help him. But he hoped that he might be able to stop his lawyer's mind from running through all the possible scenarios of what happened that tragic night. I hoped after the trial, this is another quote, because there's nothing more that can be presented that I'd stop thinking about this. But he said, so far, that has not been the case. So really interesting comments from Randy Murdoch. He doesn't seem like that his innocence was proven, as Jim Griffin said, but within the kind of context of Jim Griffin's statement, the family may have expected a lot more based on what SLED, the state, the AG's office told them, and none of them were convinced, basically, is what Jim is saying. And it seems like that is true, that Randy Murdoch was not convinced of his guilt. All right. Hit that like button if you guys are enjoying all of these Murdoch breakdowns as we continue post-trial to see what happened, why it happened, and where we're going from here. So far, none of those comments, I think, are going to affect the appeal. I do think Jim Griffin continues to hammer home the main part of the appeal will be that 404B evidence. Let's get through these 33 minutes together for the rest of the video here. I am going to speed it up again, just like I said, so sorry if you don't enjoy that, but I have to get through as much as I can.
James, first of all, what was your juror number?
Okay, so also, throughout, I listened to a couple different videos. It's really hard to hear the questions, but we can understand the context and the questions based on his answers. And we're here for his answers more than the questions.
5:30.
Okay. Yes. When you were first called up for jury duty, did you realize it was coming
to this case? So I wasn't positive, but we were given a questionnaire. So a lot of those questions kind of pertain to the case in some way. So I didn't know for certain, but I did think that it was going to be this case.
She asked his juror number and whether or not he knew it was going to be this case when he got picked.
What were your thoughts? I don't really think I had any thoughts. It was just, I was there to do my civic duty, and I really didn't think that I would be chosen. I had heard that there was 900 some people that were given, you know, the questionnaire and everything. So out of 900, I didn't really think that I'd be chosen.
I think that's absolutely true. They didn't think it was going to be chosen, but I think it's really hard. Like, I just think of myself, right? And I know how this process goes. I know how you're supposed to think. I know how you're supposed to be. But let's just say I got called in for, you know, some Tom Cruise trial. I'd be like, holy crap, it's Tom Cruise. Not to say Alec Murdoch is Tom Cruise, but I don't think I would have no thoughts about it. But maybe he did. And he's a 22-year-old kid. So it's possible he's just like, I didn't have any thoughts about it. I'm 22, man. What do I care? I don't know these people. But that's the way he thought about it. He did not think of him as some local celebrity.
Was the Murdoch case something that everybody talked about around here? Or was it something that just kind of something that happened? And, I don't know.
Now she's asking him like,
I think that it was talked about a fair amount, but I actually work over in Charleston. I've been up in Clemson at school. So I haven't really been in the area for like the past 4 years. So, I mean, it's something you hear about, but it's not something that I have so many other things going on. It's not something that I dedicated a lot of my time talking about or paying attention to.
So he's heard about it, but
yes.
Okay. So he's been away at college.
22.
Oh, okay. Oh my gosh. So you're around Paul Murdoch's age.
Yeah. Well, I would have been the same age as him in 2021 as far as whenever he passed away.
Same age as Paul when he passed away. It's crazy.
We've heard reports you guys deliberated for 2 hours and 50 minutes. I went upstairs last night to figure out what was going on. And somebody said, we asked them if they wanted dinner. And they said, no, we'll be home in 10 minutes. So it went fairly quickly for a 6-week trial. So
she's asking about how quick the process was.
Well, I will say that whenever, you know, we'd asked if we wanted dinner, we were actually rounding up our last few questions that anybody had. So it wasn't that we already had an answer. It was more so that we knew that the questions that we had answers to. We just wanted to talk through them and make sure they made sense. So we just needed that extra 10, 30 minutes. I think it was about 30 minutes that we actually took. And it wasn't that, you know, we'd already had the decision, but we knew that we were right there at it.
So the whole 2 hours and 50 minutes, what went on like in the beginning, like just going through the instructions or?
Well, we had a pretty good idea of what the instructions were just because the judge read them to us. But I would say when we first got in there, what was important to us was just to see where everybody was at and make sure if everybody was on the same page, maybe we just need to talk through things, make sure that it all makes sense to everybody.
What's interesting is we always wonder as lawyers, will this be the type of jury that's going to go back and reread the instructions, or are they just going to rely on what the judge says? It's hard not to glaze over when the judge reads all those instructions. A lot of you watch them on other channels and it's like, oh, this is so boring, I can barely get through it. A lot of times juries think that way too. So it seems like they did not reread them, which is not a requirement of a jury. It's just interesting. And, you know, we talk about that as lawyers. Are they going to reread them? Are they not? Seems like this jury did not.
But we did have a few that weren't on the same page. So we did like an anonymous vote at the beginning just to see where everybody was at. And once we found that out, we kind of just opened the floor for anybody who ever had questions. And then we would talk through those. We had the evidence in the other room. So if we had questions regarding a certain thing, we were able to refer back. And we just went one question at a time. We didn't want anybody to not be able to say anything. So we did take turns speaking. So anybody was talking over anybody. If anybody left, we made sure to wait until they come back. We didn't want anybody to be left out or anybody to miss any piece of information. That's all.
Yeah. So it doesn't sound like it was contentious at all.
I think more so than somebody being dead set on one thing or the other. We all.
All that's very common, right? Take the vote. We already know all that.
All, I think we're very good in taking all the evidence and not jumping to any conclusions, but rather taking all the evidence and seeing where it led us. Whenever we got to the end and there were some people that weren't convinced, I don't think it was so much that they knew that he was not guilty as they just weren't sure yet. Might not have known answers to certain questions. So that's when it really took that 2 hours to kind of walk through something they might not understand, go back to the evidence, go back and see what somebody said about something and answer those questions for those people. Like I said, it wasn't that they knew that he was not guilty, but they just weren't sure and they needed the answers to those questions and we were able to get those.
So it's like a 9-3 vote.
And there you go. Okay. So this is it. They had questions. They needed answers to those questions. And we provided those answers. Leader jurors provided the answers to questions that I'm not going to say they weren't leader jurors that were on the not guilty side. They probably had to have some gumption to them to even vote not guilty when everybody else was voting guilty. But that's when we talk about what is important about closing argument. I would be willing to bet my house that closing argument did not convince Juror James. But what it did do is give him the answers to the questions that the not guilty votes had. And that is what I talk about when I say arming your jurors that believe you, believe your theory, believe your evidence, believe what you believe and are telling them. They believe you, they listen, they get those answers so that when the jurors do have the questions back there in the jury room, we try to guess what questions will they have? What do they not like about our case? What holes do they find? Let's fill those holes. Let's give answers to those questions so that jurors like James can go back there, give the answers to those not guilty jurors, convince them to come over to the guilty side, which is the right side. That's what we believe as the Attorney General's office, as the prosecutors in this case. Let's give him those answers so he can go tell them and be our voice back in the jury room. That's what closing argument is for. You're not doing a lot of convincing. You're doubling, tripling down, giving the evidence to the people that already agree with you so they can go make those arguments. And on the flip side, the defense was trying to give those two or three not guilty or unsure votes what they need to vote not guilty and to argue back and answer James's questions. But it sounds like that's not the way it went.
Yes, it was.
And then slowly, how many votes did you take?
We took one at the beginning. We, like I said, went through all the questions that anybody had. And then at the end, we took another vote. And we not only took that other vote, but we went back through beginning to end about all the details and the facts just to make sure that, you know, somebody's story didn't differ from somebody else's. We were all pretty sure that we knew what had happened and we knew who had pulled the trigger. So then we took a vote at the end and then we took a moment to gather ourselves. We wanted to make sure that everybody was, they knew what they were going to say as far as what they thought and what their vote was going to be. We didn't want anybody to have any questions. We didn't want anybody to feel nervous about what they were saying or that they weren't sure. And we wanted everybody to make sure that that's what they said because that's how they felt. We didn't want anybody to feel peer pressured or like they had to say something.
I love that. I love that. Every jury should do that because you are going to be polled. You are going to be asked, what was your vote? Is this your vote? Do you agree with this vote? And you have to be sure. You don't want to be like, ah, James forced me to do this. You don't want that. Nobody wants that. The leader jurors don't want that. The follower jurors won't want that. So they double and triple down and everybody's listening. So we've had cases before. There was a case when I was at the state, not that I tried, but that I heard where somebody, there was one person I was like, and they were kind of wavering and they felt pressured. But then all the other jurors were like, well, when we were back there, they didn't say they were pressured. They voted, you know, this way. And there was some discussion and ended up they did vote guilty and they stuck with that vote of guilty. But there was some discussion. So you don't want that to happen where one juror is like, oh, I don't really know, or they were so nervous back there. You don't want to push too hard as a leader juror, right? You don't want to say, get over here, get over to my side. You're screwing all this up for all of us. You're going to let a guilty killer free and he's going to go kill other people. You don't want to do stuff like that. You want it to be their verdict. You want it to be their vote so that they're confident when they go get asked in open court that they come together and there's power in numbers and you feel like you have the other 11 jurors with you. So that was a really good explanation by James there.
What were some of the questions that people had? Because obviously this was...
What questions did the jurors have?
And you weren't allowed to take
this. Yeah, it was very tough, but I will say that everyone in the jury pool, they paid very close attention. That was actually one of our concerns towards the beginning, was not having anything to, you know, take down notepads. But in the jury room, we were able to have paper and pen. So if we had any questions, that's kind of where we would write down our questions and we save them all the way until deliberation. A lot of times those questions were answered throughout the trial. So those questions didn't make it deliberation because they were answered by another witness or somebody else. But we were able to write back there. So we would just have to, you know, wait for one of those 15-minute breaks and then jot it down real quick. So that's kind of how we got through that, of not having anything to write it down.
That's really interesting.
And as that is much better than no notes at all. But it's hardly as good as having notes while you're watching hours of testimony, in my opinion. But it's definitely better than no notes.
People had, I mean, were there some things that the three were thinking, did they have the same questions or were they just things they couldn't remember? Can you give me an example?
So I think that one of the questions were regarding kind of the gun situation. I think that there was maybe a couple people that weren't very familiar with firearms. So it was, and I completely understand, it's a little hard to understand how you can match a casing to a gun if you don't have that gun. And I think it was important to, you know, realize that they weren't matching a casing to a gun. They were matching a casing to another casing that had been shot by the same gun. And we knew that.
So one of the main questions was about the gun. How do we connect these guns? How do we connect these firearms? And he said it was important to explain that it wasn't about this. It was about that. So again, the expert that the state brought gave James and other jurors what they needed to explain and answer these questions to show it was a Murdoch family gun. Really interesting, right? Because if they didn't believe, they would have been able to be like, no. First off, it sounds like some jurors didn't even understand that expert, which is understandable. But some jurors could have just been like, I didn't believe it. I don't think you can actually do that. But James made a very important comment. There were a lot of jurors who had no experience or didn't understand firearms. So what are they going to do? Well, somebody like James or other jurors in there that do have more experience that are able to explain firearms to them, they're obviously going to be like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Thank you for explaining that to me because your life experience gives you more knowledge in that area. Which is exactly why jury selection is so important. Whatever the issues are in your case, you have to be careful about who you pick that has experience, that's able to explain stuff, that's able to be an authority, an authoritative figure back in the jury room. Like when we have doctors on a case where there are medical issues, the jury's going to sit back there and be like, okay, doc, tell us what you think. It could be a veterinarian. It could be any kind of a dentist. But if it's a medical case, they'll be like, well, this dentist probably knows more than me. I'm a carpenter or whatever. Very interesting, right? That's why jury selection is so important in getting into people's life experience. Because if they believe what you believe and what you're arguing, they'll be able to explain to the other jurors. If they don't, they'll be able to explain the other jurors away from you.
The gun that shot one of those casings had been seen by one of the witnesses that Paul was shooting that gun with his friend. So then you know that both those casings had been cycled through the same gun. And that casing was at the crime scene. So that's how you're able to place that gun at the crime scene.
Really interesting for him to say, you know that, and that it was the gun Paul was using. It's like, really? I didn't remember anybody saying he used the one without the thermal scope, which I believe is the one that was missing, was the one without the thermal scope. I thought the gun stuff was really confusing about which guns were missing. But I guess they were thinking, oh, it was one of the guns in the courtroom. I feel like if you ask that jury, they think it was one of the guns in the courtroom because they couldn't be ruled out or confirmed as the murder weapons, which is why the state put all of them in, I think.
Family gun.
When you got out there and you know, did you look at him? What was that like?
So throughout the entire trial, one of the things that I wanted to do, just because I felt like it benefited me, is watch both sides, both the prosecution and the defense, and see what their reactions were to certain things that were said. So my eyes were constantly going from prosecution to defense to the witness. You know, I wanted to see everybody's reactions and how people were taking things, what their responses were. So whenever we got out there to, you know, express what our verdict was, I wanted to watch and see how the defense and the defendant reacted. So I know that I'd heard somebody say that was in the audience that we never looked, but I know that for me, I looked at the defense. I wanted to see what the reaction was.
Was there anything that stood out?
I think that the only thing that stood out to me, and it wasn't shocking to me, but was that there was no reaction. It was just a straight face.
So he expected all this stuff when he was on the stand because he's a lawyer, because he's a trial lawyer, because he knows how this stuff works. He's done this before, but he was shocked that there was no reaction when Alec knew exactly, he knew it was going to be a guilty verdict. We all did. And he knew he was going to get consecutive life sentences. Neither of those two things were a surprise once it was a short deliberation and the sentencing was the next day where nobody even testified. Nothing was submitted. We've watched sentencing hearings together. I've handled sentencing hearings. We submit letters. We have people come and speak on their behalf. So none of that was a surprise. They knew nothing was going to affect the sentence. They knew what the sentence was. So no reaction, I think, knowing he's a lawyer, is less surprising than if it would have just been a layperson. Not to say he couldn't have reacted, but I think it's interesting because when you listen to the jurors' way stuff, they said, oh, he's a lawyer, so we expect this. He knew how to talk to us, knew how to turn it on and off. It wasn't real remorse. He was, you know, making a closing argument to us. But then I was shocked when he didn't react to a verdict that he knew was coming. It's kind of interesting.
How important was that to you? And was it to you? Because to me, it seems to be the biggest part, or at least one of the biggest pieces of the state's case.
I think it's a very crucial piece, and I think that it's incredible timing as to when they were able to get it, and I think it's incredible timing on Paul's part. I don't think that anyone would have ever known that he was down there if it wasn't for that video. I think that there's a lot of evidence that points towards Alex, but I feel like that does solidify it. He can't, you know, deny that he was there at that point because there's a video that places him there. I think that it speaks a lot that somebody that couldn't speak, somebody that couldn't be a witness, was able to be a witness even after they had passed away.
I keep saying that the little detective, you know, gathered a piece of evidence to help in his own murder investigation,
right?
You know, unwittingly, you know, he was just trying to take a picture of Cash or a video of Cash's tail,
right?
Were there other pieces of evidence that you thought were really critical?
I think that every piece of evidence was critical. You know, I've heard a lot about when was the point that you really felt like, you know, you were going to sway one way or the other, and it was very important to me to not make that decision prematurely. So I would say that I never made a decision until after both closing arguments, after I knew that all the evidence.
I would love to know what this guy's background is. He's saying all the right things. Right? I don't see a single appellate issue with a single thing that he has said, which as a prosecutor would make me really excited. And he did things the right way. And we got to the right and just verdict. If you're the prosecutor in this case, so he's doing a really good job explaining the process for the most part about, you know, how, what he did, what he thinked, how he waited. It wasn't just a single piece of evidence. It was all the evidence. Really interesting.
I felt confident making a decision because I think that if you make a decision before you're able to see all the pieces of the puzzle, you know, you may have done, you know, you may have gotten in front of yourself. I think that for me, I am familiar with firearms. So being able to place both of those guns there, and although it was not, the shot shells were not a match to either of the shotguns, it was very interesting that one of the shotguns that happened to be one of Alex's favorite was missing. So that was kind of important to me. It was important to me.
It was very interesting that one of the shotguns was missing. Very, you know, this is a defense's nightmare. That he was connecting these dots that were not connected, that the state did not connect. He was connecting them with just small jumps.
That they could place both those guns there based off of the match markings on the shot shells and spent casings. I'd say another piece of evidence that was important to me was his own time on the witness stand. It was just, there was a lot of things that you were able to gather based off of what he said, how he said it, how he was reacting.
Did he ever make eye contact with you? I kept seeing him look over. I didn't know if he was looking at just a few of the jurors, or did you ever...
So, like I said, I was constantly looking at prosecution, defense, and the witness on the stand throughout the entire trial. Being able to make eye contact with somebody is, I don't know why, but I'll make eye contact with people a lot, especially during the trial. And it was something that I noticed, that he very rarely ever made eye contact with me. And I don't know if it was on purpose or if it was just because I always sat all the way on the end. You know, I was kind of away from the rest of the jury once we lost a few alternates.
Also, another thing that lawyers get very OCD about is make sure you make contact with every single juror. Make sure you don't leave a juror out. Don't just make eye contact with one jury or juror. This guy was taking it very seriously, down to who was making eye contact with him and who was not. And Alec Murdoch did not make enough eye contact with him to convince him. It's wild, right? It's wild. The stuff that we are so anxious and wound tight about as trial lawyers, a lot of it comes true. This is where we get it. This is jury research. We are doing jury research right now together, learning about what jurors think, real jurors who make big decisions. These are the people that could potentially be on our jury. And then based on his background, that's why I'd like to know his background. Because when you know, have a juror member who thinks this certain way and does these certain things, it's more likely to be connected to similar jurors to him. And that's kind of how you build out who your perfect juror is and who the juror you might not want on a case is. Very interesting.
But that was something that I noticed, is just that we didn't make very much eye contact.
Interesting. Did you see... tears from him.
Did you see tears?
I saw them sometimes, but obviously I'm either watching on television or in his courtroom, and this episode is to me. Mm-hmm. Did you see tears?
Yes, I did. I know that some people may have said that he did or didn't, but whenever I watched a lot of people, there was 6 weeks worth of time where I was just watching people and listening to people. And I would say that there were several times that he was crying.
What's also interesting is he said, I heard some people said there were no tears. So he is watching the other juror interviews as well, which I just think is interesting. What people consume and what they take in. Really, really interesting.
They were genuine or not, I don't know. But I would say that he was crying certain parts of the trial.
Did you believe anything that he said?
I think that he is... I think that he's good at being able to talk to people. And I think that part of the way that he is able to be so good at talking to people is that he's convincing. And I think that whenever he's convincing himself as well. And I think he's able to do that because he often meshes the truth with a lie. So I think that there was some truth. And I think that it's true that he did love his family. But I think that he also mixes lies in there. And whether those, what those are and where you differentiate those, I'm not sure. But I think that at times he was telling the truth. And I think at times.
So he meshed truth and lies. He's not really sure what the truth was or where the lies were, but he knows he mixed them in and he believes he did love his family. Interesting.
He was lying.
Was there a specific point where you thought, I mean, obviously we know he was telling the truth about being there with the kennels, but maybe you felt, obviously, he didn't tell the truth when you talked about leaving the kennels, because I remember a specific portion of that testimony where Creighton Waters asked him, well, what did you say to Maggie when you left the kennels? Or did you just get on the golf cart and go? Did you catch that? And he said things like, well, I would have said, you know, if you were leaving the kennels, I would have said.
He was saying, you know, I can't remember what I said, but I would have said, you know, yeah. I know exactly what you're saying. He said, well, I would have said bye or something, because I think they were trying to establish how much time he was down there after that video before he went back. And he was saying, well, you know, I would have said bye. I wouldn't have just hauled back to the house. Again, I forget what your question was originally, but
was there anything that's in particular that stood out about that? It's probably a bad question on my part. Like, I just noticed that he got really quiet when asked about, well, what did you say to Maggie? Did you say bye?
About, you know, Alex's last comments to Maggie and Paul.
I think that it was pointed out throughout the trial, well, particularly that portion of the trial, that there's a lot of things that he was able to remember vividly, and there was a lot of things that he was not able to recall. And
that's exactly
that I paid attention to, because
literally exactly what the state argued. Arming him with the answers to questions. Exactly what the state argued in their closing.
Some of the things that he could remember vividly are things that I wouldn't remember tomorrow. And then some of the things that he couldn't remember vividly were things that I wouldn't forget in 10 years. So there's, and whether that's just a difference on what.
Also, I will say, to give the chat credit, a lot of what you said as well. He's mirroring a lot of what you guys said while watching this trial.
It's important to who, you know, whether him and I differ on what we would find priority to remember or what we would kind of, you know, forget about. I don't know. I don't know every person in the world, but I found it interesting some of the things that he was able to remember and some things that he was not.
So was the testimony, was his, him taking the stand, was that, did that kind of clinch it for you? I mean, you said you didn't make up your mind until the end, until the closing arguments were finished.
Mm-hmm.
But was that something major that really was part of your decision?
I said earlier, I think that all the evidence, all the witnesses, they were all a major part of the trial. Whether one weighed more than other, I think that there were some things that you could kind of rely on a little bit better. Whenever he did get on the stand, I know that it was very abnormal. I've never been a juror before and I've never sat through trial before, but I didn't.
So how do you know it's abnormal, right? He's going to tell us, but he said, when he took the stand, I knew it was very abnormal. So who were you talking to about this? How did you find out it was abnormal for a defendant to take the stand in a criminal trial? Wonder if he watches, you know, LawTube, or if he's, you know, interested in, you know, law and crime and these trials that are getting publicized on YouTube. So he's learning a lot throughout the process here, like a lot of you are. It's interesting. Very interesting.
No, the defendant taking the stand was very abnormal. I wouldn't say that at that point that sealed the deal.
And he didn't tell us. I would like to know how he knew that it was abnormal for the defendant to take the stand. He's a 22-year-old guy. Let me know in the chat. Did all of you know it's abnormal for a defendant to take the stand? And how do you know? Let me know. Where did you learn that it is unusual, very unusual for a criminal defendant to take the stand? College, friend, family, movie, YouTube, watching these cases. Let me know. Let me know.
I tried to weigh it both ways. I tried to see if what he was saying and if it was the truth made sense, then that would make sense. But then I ran it the other way. And if what he was saying just didn't add up, then it didn't add up. So I tried to do that with each piece of evidence. I tried to run it both ways as to if it was true and if it wasn't true, if I could rely on it or if I couldn't, and then which one made more sense and which one, you know, kind of how they were saying about the circumstantial evidence, did it all point to the same conclusion? You know, which one of these, whether it was the truth or whether it wasn't and wasn't reliable, which one points to the conclusion and fits the story better?
How important was Dr. Kinsey's testimony?
So that answer right there sounded a lot more like my civil trial burden of more likely than not. Two stories. Which one is more likely true? That's the civil burden. Whichever one is more like, even if there's some truth to this one, that's okay, because this one is more likely true. That is not the way a criminal burden should be looked at. I'm not, he did his duty. He did his job. He voted. It counts. He's guilty. Just please relax with that. We're talking about the process as a whole and discussing how lawyers and how the law expects jurors to look at something. It doesn't mean that's how jurors are going to look at it. But beyond reasonable doubt should not be to see kind of which story fits better.
He talked about it a lot. And he's very knowledgeable. I would say that he was, you know, a very big part of the case, as well as, you know, a majority of the team. I found it very interesting, some of the things that he talked about, just because it was things that I was interested in. I think it was very interesting as to how he walked through the crime scene, things that he noticed, things that he really, you know, dug into, and things that really caught his eye. But, you know, whether he was extremely, you know, the biggest part of the case or something like that, I think that he was extremely important, and definitely gave us a lot of good information.
Did you ever feel like the prosecution was getting way too into the weeds with financial stuff? That's something that we thought they were getting too into the weeds with. Did that bother you guys? Because sometimes you guys look a little bored when, not you specifically, but some of the jurors.
I will say that it's whole new experience for me, just for the last part of that question. So I don't think that I was really bored. A lot of times, you know, maybe I was a little uncomfortable for sitting there for a while, but I was still interested. I thought that, you know, it's a very interesting situation, very interesting case. But as far as for what your original question was, I don't think they got too far into the weeds, because I don't know. That's a tough one for me to answer. It's all evidence, you know, whether it was just for the motive. The financial stuff doesn't, you know, it's not a factor on whether he was behind the trigger or not, to me. You know, that was something they didn't have to prove. They didn't have to prove motive, but.
Well, that was good. That was a really good answer. The financial stuff was not something that was going to prove whether or not he was behind the trigger. And that's important.
They felt that it was important for us to, you know, see that evidence. So anything that, in my opinion, anything that they put on the table for us to hear, it's important to hear, because the judge has made the decision that that's important for us to hear. So I personally don't think that they got too far into the weeds.
Man, he understands the process. He understands the process. If they put it before us, it's important. It's admissible. It's relevant. And the judge has to allow us to be able to hear it. He picked all that up. I think that's great. I mean, I think that's really great. Seems like a great juror.
But somebody else may think differently than me.
Sure. Did you have any feelings about the lawyers on this side? Do you think they're all good? Or, I mean, did you have any feelings?
What do you think about the lawyering? Again,
I have a lot of respect.
This is the first time I'm watching this interview, so I'm learning a lot of it for the first time as well. I've seen clips of things elsewhere, but I have not watched this full 30-minute interview. I like to watch it for the first time with you all.
For all of them, they all put a lot of hard work and time into the case. I think I would respect all of them. I don't think that I had a favorite. I think that some of them definitely, you know, just had a different style of being a lawyer. And being my first time, you know, sitting in the trial like that, it was just interesting to see how each one of them, what angle they took, how they worked through the case. So, you know, I just have a lot of respect for all of them for putting so much time and effort into the case.
You, most of you, to the sentencing today. Did you all decide as a group to do that?
Yeah, so I think that a lot of us were tired last night. We spent a long 6 weeks. We weren't able to talk about anything for 6 weeks, and that all came to a point last night. I think that afterwards, we all kind of decided that we'd made a very big decision, and we did not want to jump, you know, out there and start talking to people. We decided that we just wanted to kind of chill out and go home for the night. Last night, we decided that we were going to ask everybody. If nobody wanted to talk, nobody had to. If people didn't want to come to the sentencing, they didn't have to. But a lot of us did want to stand together. You know, we wanted to go there. We wanted to finish this out as a group. I will say that all the jurors were very incredible people, and we all come from different walks of life, and we were able to bond over the 6 weeks. So a lot of us, you know, some of us had particular reasons why we couldn't be there, and it's not that anybody didn't want to stand together. We were all unified, but certain people just couldn't make it today.
I love that, and I talk about the chat, how they represent what jurors should be: different walks of life, different thought processes, diverse way of thinking, and seems like they had that here in this jury as well. And we've seen that just with, you know, age, race, gender. Just in, I've seen four jurors give interviews. And again, they're different backgrounds, you know, and they have different walks of life and different experiences that they bring to the table, which is how the chat should be, which is how the jury should be, which is how the country should be. And again, regardless of all those different backgrounds, they were able to come together and make a decision and get an answer in this case rather quickly, which I think, hey, it's part of the process, right? Whether you agree or disagree with the verdict, the process did go the way that it should. And I don't really have an issue with the jury and their verdict. If I was going to have an issue with the case, it would be what evidence was allowed in, you know, specifically the other bad acts, right? That would be my biggest issue I had with the case. Because again, I said from the jump, as soon as I came in, it's really hard for a jury of lay people to let a guy like that go, knowing he has done all this wrong for the last 20 years.
But as a group, we did decide that we wanted to come back today. We wanted to finish out the trial. And then we would go from there as far as talking to anybody, or, you know, we want to make sure that everybody was comfortable with it. Nobody was getting out, you know, in front of themselves or in front of the jury.
What did you think of what he said today? He said, "I'm innocent," and Judge Newman kind of had this back and forth with him.
I don't really think that, you know, I was just there to hear what he had to say, but I think that Judge Newman did a very good job of, you know, finishing out the trial. And I think that everything that he said was a very good representation of Judge Newman. And I think that he had a, you know.
Were you surprised that Alec didn't say, you know, "I'm sorry for the things that I've done," or anything? I mean, he said, "I'm innocent. I didn't hurt them or wouldn't hurt them." I mean, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, usually, sometimes a defendant will throw themselves in the mercy of the court and, you know, ask for leniency or ask for the lightest sentence he could have been given 30 years. But there was none of that. Did you have a reaction to that?
I came today to finish out the trial, and, you know, I definitely wanted to hear what he had to say, if he had to say anything. I didn't think that he would say anything. I think that I thought that he may have felt like he already said enough. You know, he'd already said that he would or would not have done. So I didn't really expect him to say anything. Whenever he did, I took it with a grain of salt.
Your constitution tie, tell me about that. I mean, why do you have a U.S. constitution tie?
Well, I don't really own very many ties, but my dad has quite a few. So at the beginning of the trial, I wanted to be a good representation of the community and my peers. So I made it a point to, you know, be presentable and dress nicely every day. So, you know, every once in a while I throw in a tie, and this is actually one of my...
I will tell you. So one of the things we talk about as well is jurors that dress up and that take time putting themselves together and trying to be presentable to court like he's describing. So I guess he did dress kind of like this throughout the trial. Those are the serious jurors. Those are the leader jurors. Usually those are prosecution-leaning jurors. That's what the research does show in criminal cases. In civil cases, they can go either way, but they're usually leader jurors.
Dad ties, but I felt like it was very fitting for the, you know, trial. So I wore it several times throughout the past 6 weeks. And I felt like today, with the end of it all, it was a very good day to wear something representing our judiciary system.
Yeah. But you're a snappy dresser. I noticed it every time I saw you in court. So, you know, I think that's great to show great respect for the court, because there are some things people don't always do that. Jameson, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I think that I have quite a few things to say. I think that there was a lot of people that put a lot of time and effort into the case. I have a lot of respect for all those people. I think they worked very hard and I think they worked very diligently. I think that some people were put in some tight spots and they didn't want to overstep their boundaries, but they still were able to get their job done ultimately. And I think that came from a lot of help from Paul. I think that as the jurors, we also...
That's interesting. I wonder if he's talking about the lay witnesses. I wonder if he's talking about SLED. Is he talking about the lawyers? It's interesting.
So did have a tough 6 weeks. I think that a lot of credit from that would go to Faith. I think very many times throughout the 6 weeks, we prayed together. We prayed before we went in. We prayed before we came out to give the verdict.
Interesting.
I would say that was a huge factor in us being able to sit comfortably with our decision.
So you felt like God was maybe guiding you a little bit?
Absolutely. I think that having clarity of mind and just asking to, you know.
That's interesting. They felt like God was guiding them. And they were very comfortable with their decision. So some of the questions, especially when it's a life or death case, is how do you feel about sitting in judgment of someone? It's interesting. You never know if it's based around religion, which way religion is going to take you in that, right? I don't think everybody in whatever religion it is always goes the same way in that. So those are some interesting comments. Again, not appealable issues or anything like that, but just interesting.
Allow me to be able to hear what I need to hear.
You saw some really horrible things. Did that affect you?
I think it would affect anybody. But I will say that whenever I'm sitting up there, I try not to think too much about myself. And I try to think about what I need to be seeing. I know that these are important images that I need to be seeing so that I can take in all the evidence. You know, there might be something that I see that may stick with me. And although it may be gruesome, it's something that has to be seen for Paul and Maggie.
Interesting.
I also think that regardless, this is an incredibly difficult time for the family. And I hate it for all of them.
Were you impacted by Buster testifying at all?
Again, whenever I'm up there, I try not to think about myself or how I'm impacted. I just try to listen as closely as I can to everything that they're saying and retain as much information as I can, just so that I can have the most honest and true opinion that I'm capable of having. So, you know, I can't say how I was feeling in the moment or what I thought. I was just taking every single word that they said and trying to pick it apart and make it all fit together and, you know, just really retain all that information.
And you're feeling okay with, I mean, just, and I'm saying, you know, it sounds like you're very mature for your age, for 22. I mean, these are some horrible images that you guys had to see. I didn't get to see them, but I can only imagine what you were told was on the images. How are you feeling? I mean, I know you'll probably still be compressing from this.
You know, we spoke earlier. I think that a lot of the jurors were going to need more time to just really get a grasp on that it's over. We're done with the trial and now we have to get back to our lives. I think that it'll take a bit more time to really know how we're all feeling. But at the moment, I'm just, you know, I'm secure in my decision. And there were definitely some awful things that we had to look at and that we had to see. And some of those may stick with some of the jurors and all the jurors for a very, very long time. They were definitely not something that you see every day and something that you hope to never have to.
And a lot of you asked that and how they can deal with it and what the court provides. Maybe he'll let us know what this court provides, but he said he was able to kind of separate it, but there were some jurors that didn't. And that's pretty commonplace that, you know, every juror looks at this stuff differently and it affects everybody differently.
Just ears. Something you hope never happens, but it's just going to, you know, take time for a lot of people, I'm sure.
And you said, you know, you had to do this for Maggie and Paul. Do you feel like you have a clear idea of what happened that night?
I do, just based off of the evidence. And, you know, obviously there's some differing opinions from different witnesses and stuff. But I do think that being able to see all the evidence, hear all the witnesses, and just seeing where everything played out, being able to go out there to the actual crime scene itself, and you're able to see how close proximity, and you're able to see different little things that maybe weren't pointed out in by any of the witnesses or any of the, you know, prosecution defense, you're able to kind of picture it, and you're able to kind of see what happened. And that kind of goes back to earlier whenever you were asking if I think that he told any truth whenever he was on the stand. And I think that it makes sense for him to go down there on the golf cart. I don't think that he went down there originally with him. So, you know, that's one of the parts of the truth that he, I believe, filtered in with most of the lie.
Do you think he, you know,
interesting.
He wanted him to come and he said no? Do you think there was a confrontation about the pills? And do you have any?
Well, that kind of goes.
See, this is interesting now. She's asking him specific questions about what he think happened that not wasn't necessarily proven, but was argued. And he said, yeah, I believe he did go back there at the golf cart with not at the same time as them. And then she asked a more specific question, I think, about why or the pills or something like that.
To another question that you asked earlier about him on the stand and things that he said. So that was one thing that I kind of noticed is he's up there and he's talking a lot. Oftentimes the prosecution would just let him run with it. Whenever he started to say something, they just wouldn't say much and they would let him build on it and build on it. And whenever he was talking about whether she was going to come or whether she wasn't, he had mentioned that there had been prior testimony that any time that she was going to be going to the beach, that she was going to be taking the dogs. So he used that and he said that she didn't have the dogs. So she was obviously planning on coming back to Moselle, but she was going to a doctor's appointment. And I know that you can't take your dogs into the doctor's office and she's not going to leave them in the hot car. So I don't really think that proves anything. And they were also having work done down there at a stove. You don't want your dogs running around the house whenever you've got work going on down there. So
all this stuff and all these reasons why, even though Murdoch would give a reason as to why he thought Maggie was going to stay because the dogs or whatever it may be, instead, he's like, well, no. She went to a doctor's appointment. She couldn't bring him there. There was work done. You didn't want the dogs at the house while work's being done. I feel like, based on Alex's testimony, that the dogs were at Edisto even while the work was being done. So that might have been a question that the defense could have answered that they didn't answer. And those are some of the interesting things as a lawyer when you look at this, that you try to answer as many questions as possible, but you never would have thought that that question would have come up, but they should have answered it. Well, you say Maggie would have had the dogs at Edisto with her if she was staying there. But what about the work being done at the house? Does she want the dogs around? And they could have been like, yes. 20 witnesses could have answered yes to that if it was yes. And if it was no as the prosecutor, that would have been a good question for them to answer this question for sure for him. Now he got there anyway, but have somebody say, no, she never kept the dogs there because of the work that was being done. Just very interesting what jurors pick up on.
There's just some little things like that that didn't really add up. You know, I felt like he was trying to put something in there to solidify his story, but really it was just kind of a little bit more questionable.
Do you think that Maggie was using the hose in the panel video?
Who was using the hose is the question here.
Do you have any thoughts on what you think happened?
You know, we don't have a dead set time on when everything happened as far as after the video. We know there's a period of time between whenever that video ends and whenever he picks up his phone at the house. I think that I hear a hose in the background whenever they're taking the video. And I know that Alec is calling for Bubba. So I do think that Maggie was probably washing out the dog pens. And I think that he was getting the chicken. And that was another part of his testimony is he was saying, you know, Bubba is running up to me. He's wanting to show me the chicken. He's wanting to get it to me. He's proud of it. But at the same time, you hear him holler for Bubba 2 to 3 times in the video. It doesn't really seem like he's, you know, running up to him. It kind of seems like he's having to call him to him.
That's interesting.
And I know that I've got.
So he thinks Maggie was using the hose, but he thinks he lied about Bubba coming up to him. Interesting.
Several dogs. And there are dogs that are happy and they want to run around with it themselves, you know. So there's just small things like that. Like I said, I was listening to every word and I was trying to just make it make sense. And there's some things that are just like, well, that doesn't really make sense with what I saw in the video, or that doesn't make sense with what I heard here. Things like that.
Do you think he tossed the phone out when they think he did that night?
You know, I'm not sure. I think that he had the phone at some point in time and there's a debate on whether it would turn on or whether it wouldn't. And we have no idea how he threw the phone. We have no idea whether he was.
No idea how he threw the phone, but they do believe he had the phone at some time. So they disregarded the steps going at the same time. They disregarded, you know, the OnStar data that didn't necessarily put the car where the phone was being thrown out. That's why he said, I don't know how he threw the phone. He did not believe the expert who was throwing it around in the room. So that's good. I'm glad they didn't rely on that guy for much. But just interesting, they did piece these facts together in their minds. And it seems like you don't need to piece all these facts together to come to a verdict. So I don't know if all the jurors agree here, but this is his version of the events and how he thought they were proved to him.
Holding it in his hand the whole time and had it turned off, we don't know. But it makes sense to me for him to have filmed the phone.
I really appreciate it. Anything else you want to add? Yeah, sure. So do you think if he hadn't taken the stand, but how did him testifying sort of affect things for you guys? Is it possible that maybe it would have left? I mean, could you see it had been a not guilty verdict if he hadn't taken the stand? I'm trying to kind of get how that played into it. Did that like solidify things in your mind? Or
I think it was an aspect, and I think it was a part of the trial, but I don't think it was the make or break point. And I don't think that it was a situation where if he didn't take the stand, he wouldn't have been found guilty.
Interesting.
I think that there was enough evidence there gathered by Sled and produced by Paul that it was there. He was there.
So he doesn't think that he would have been guilty without him taking the stand, but he waited. He didn't make his decision until all the evidence was out, but he thinks he would have still been guilty even if he didn't take the stand, which I think is really interesting, right? All this stuff, just piecing it together. There are no perfect answers, right? Anybody that gives a 30-minute interview, you're going to be able to try to pick stuff apart. So that's not what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to understand what is important in this juror's mind. That's what I'm trying to understand, just as a lawyer who talks to juries a lot.
And I think that we all, you know, had enough evidence there that whenever we went and deliberate, there was enough there, whether he got on the stand or not.
Without the Kimmel video, do you think there was enough there?
I'm not sure because there was the kennel video. And, you know, like I said, I made my decision at the end of the trial whenever I had all the evidence.
That's interesting. So what if there was no kennel video? He said, I'm not sure because there was the kennel video. I like that answer.
You know, I'd have to go all the way back to the beginning and forget everything I knew and then go without the kennel video to be able to make that call. There was a lot of evidence. And I just know that that was a part of it and a crucial part of it. And I think that who it was provided by spoke a lot.
Did the most opposite take you more toward guilty or not guilty?
Who the evidence was provided by. So that's interesting. And then now they ask about the Moselle visit.
Again, like I said earlier, I waited until the end to make my decision. But whenever I'm at the end and I'm, you know, thinking about all this evidence, there was parts that I noticed at the Moselle property that, you know, were evident to me that solidified my answer of guilty. There was a lot of question about.
So what he saw solidified his answer of guilty, right? And he's saying he didn't make his decision until after closing arguments, which you don't have to wait to make your decision until after closing arguments. That's not how it works. I think he was saying that because he thinks that's the right answer, but he's saying now that, you know, regardless of this, he would have been guilty. I went to see Moselle and it confirmed that he was guilty. That's okay. There's nothing wrong with going to the scene and saying this confirms exactly what I thought.
So there was a lot of questioning about the second shot to Paul. And to me, the way that it was described and the way that it was portrayed, it just didn't look right. But what did make sense to me and something that I made note of before we went to the Moselle property, because I didn't know that we were going to the Moselle property, but I was curious, is that for one, I think that he would have been looking at Paul. And when we get out there, it's a very tight room. And there is about a 1 to 1.5 inch threshold at the base of that door. I think if he's looking at Paul and he's just shot a buckshot, which if you're, you know, if you're not firm, it can rock you pretty good. I think he could have been unbalanced. And I think he could have tripped over that threshold. And that puts him on the ground shooting upward as Paul's coming out. And I think that makes sense to me for the angle of the shot.
A lot of he maybe buckshot. It could knock you to the ground if you're not ready or not experienced. But then I thought Alec Murdoch was, you know, Mr. Gunman. But then he could have been knocked off balance and then firing up. So he obviously agreed with the prosecution's experts about the angles of the shot, not the defense experts, not from the top of the head, right? And as he's falling to the ground, shooting up, that makes the most sense. So then he puts down the shotgun, picks up the AR, runs outside, shoots Maggie, then goes back in and gets the shotgun and gets rid of everything in that time period. I just think that there are other questions that are brought up in my mind that don't matter at all to this jury's verdict because they determined together that this is how it happened. And again, it doesn't mean all the jurors specifically agree with exactly how he's explaining he believes the shots were fired, but it's really interesting with the coulda, probably, maybe he fell, maybe he shot up from this angle. Does not feel like he was convinced of any of this beyond a reasonable doubt when it comes to how the shots were fired. Now, he was absolutely convinced of his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the important part, but how it happened specifically, a lot of probablys, maybes, and could-haves.
Okay, one more question. Is this okay in there? Okay, why do you think he did it?
I don't think like that. I don't have the capability of thinking to be able to do something like that. So I don't think that I'd ever be able to answer why somebody would do something like that. I think that there is a lot of contributing factors that somebody could throw in. And we heard a lot throughout the trial, but I still think there's more that we haven't heard, and there still may be more that nobody knows about. I think that it doesn't make sense to do that, but I know that there's people in the world that don't make sense and they do things without making it make sense. So I don't know that there is an answer other than that it happened and that it shouldn't have. I think we can all agree on that.
James, first of all,
there's a lot we don't know that happened and it doesn't make sense. Interesting, right? To be able to put that to the side. As a prosecutor, you know that you're going to have to get a jury to put that to the side and say, this might not make sense, but it happened and it shouldn't have. And that's exactly what he said at the end, but really interesting about what they didn't know, what they weren't sure about, but they were sure that it happened. And they were sure Alec Murdoch did it and was the actual trigger man. Really interesting to me. That interview was really, really interesting. A thoughtful, smart dude who understands the process, did things right and tried to do things right. Really interesting when we get some answers like that, especially the longer it went and the more specific the questions. I would have loved them to ask, so where do you think he started? Then where do you think he went? Then what do you think he did with the weapons? That's what I would have asked. I wonder if he believed the blue tarp and the wrapping it up and the hiding it. What do you think he did with the clothes? Why do you think the clothes weren't ever found? Well, he must have gotten rid of them. He burned them. He hit them. They're in with his grandfather, whatever. Did he hear some theory, some conspiracy theory online, and that aided him in that? I'm not saying he did. I would have loved the answers to some of those specific questions because I think that's a really interesting part of this discussion. So hopefully you guys enjoyed it. Let me know what you think in the comments. Like the video if you're still into the Murdoch stuff. Hit that subscribe button because we got more coming. Appreciate you all. Until next time, I'll see you tonight at the 200K celebration. Be there or be square. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Lawyer You Know podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, which I hope you did, here's what to do next. Give it a share, rate, and review the show on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, and make sure you subscribe to the show in the listening app of your choice. Follow me on all social media platforms at Tragos Law, and join the Lawyer You Know YouTube channel and community where you can ask me questions live on all of these cases. If you've got an idea for a specific topic or you have a personal legal question on an injury case, whether it's a car accident, trip and fall, wrongful death, or catastrophic injury case, please email me at lawyeryouknow@gmail.com. All of these links I just mentioned are included in the show notes section of this episode. So until next time, I'm Peter Tragos.